Morning, my name is Dick Martin, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dick.
Everybody, by the grace of God and the actions of AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since September the 15th, 1965, and I'm very grateful for that. They didn't want to have a countdown again this year and have the same guy stand up, same ragged old guy stand up there. Well, I've been sober 40 years. But you know, we can really get started now. It's all right to have this meeting because John's here. That's an inside joke. But I'm glad to be here, glad to be in Alaska again, and glad to be up here with my friends and some guys that I sponsor and many other people that follow along. And of course, Charlie and Larry are old friends, and it's good to see them. It's good, of course, to hear Cindy. And like everyone else, I enjoyed Melissa's talk the other day. Polly turned us on to, when she finished her first segment, she was going to take a break. She says, "Well, let's get a drink." I don't know where that came from. I guess we'll just have to keep an eye on her. But, you know, it's great to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care whether you're brand new, you've been sober a long time. It's really great to remember that AA is a great thing. And it's not some small little drab meeting where people are sitting around, look like they're posing for the main character in a Hush Puppy ad. And and talking about, well, does anybody have anything they want to talk about today? You know, that's a terrible way to start an AA meeting. It really is a terrible way to start a meeting. It just turns my brain and goes click, and I just can't hear anything. Because that isn't what AA meetings are about. AA meetings are about the solution. We talk about the solution in AA meetings. We talk about the problems to our sponsors. That's what we have sponsors for. Sponsors are kind of a magic thing. What they do is they sort out. They may not know a damn thing about what our problem is. But what they do is they sort out and say, okay, you know, to get an answer to that, talk to John because he's had experience with that. Or talk to Larry. He's had experience in that. Charlie is going through that now. Why don't you talk to him? Maybe he has some solution for your problem. But what we are is kind of traffic directors. And it's nice to know that what you're doing is you're getting the shared experience of millions of people is what it really amounts to. You're not just getting your sponsor's opinion. Because what you're doing is you're getting your sponsor's experience or the experience of someone he had heard or he had met or that he had read about or whatever it has to be. So actually what a sponsor does, he gathers together the collective experience of alcoholics all over the world, alcoholics from all walks of life, alcoholics of any race, color, or creed that you want to think about. And or don't want to think about, but primarily a sponsor's there. It just kind of funnels it down to one voice, instead of you taking a lifetime trying to figure out the answer to something, and having to do all the studying and have to do all the research and that sort of thing. Just ask your sponsor. That's what they're for. We're supposed to pester our sponsors. It keeps them sober. And that's our job. You think it's their job to keep you sober, but that's not what it's about at all. Your job is to keep them sober. Speaking of collective experience, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in September of 65, and AA was different then than it is now. We had very few conferences such as this. Very few. They had the international every 5 years, just like they do now. But they had have a state conference with, you know, anywhere from two dozen to, you know, maybe 100, 150 people. They had one or two big conferences in the United States. Most of them are located in the Midwest or the West. The East didn't have anything large. Still doesn't to any great degree. I don't know. They think that this isn't AA. And if this isn't AA, I don't know what AA is, to tell you the truth. I went to my first conference in Luray, Virginia, in October of 1965, and I couldn't have been any more than 6 weeks sober. I don't think I was 6 weeks sober. And I was so mesmerized by thinking that they'd get these articulate people in for me to hear. And these people who had, you know, the collective experience of years that they were giving. And they were talking about the same things that my sponsor would tell me. And the same thing that those solution-oriented meetings were. We didn't have any step studies in those days where somebody would talk about the first step ad nauseum forever and ever and ever. Didn't have anything like that. We had very few men's or women's stag meetings. We had very few specialty meetings. I remember one time I was in broadcasting when I came to AA, and somebody snuck me into the meeting. It was for the journalism guys, the writers, and so on and so forth. I lived in Washington, D.C., and a lot of writers and newspaper people and stuff like that. And seeing as I was in communication, they let me go to this thing. And the funny thing about it is, I've been sober, and I think I was sober about a year and a half or 2 years. I've been sober longer than anybody else in that room, because they were more concerned with newspaper and more concerned with communications than they were with helping each other to stay sober. And those specialty meetings are good, I suppose, to a degree, in that we can take people who have a peculiar, not odd, but a different profession or whatever it is, and shuffle them into the mainstream of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to drink a lot. I think that's worthwhile mentioning. I remember when I was a kid, 13 or 14 years old, and I was with a buddy of mine. We were walking through the woods, and just on a hike, you know, on Saturday, and I remember we came upon this. It was a tree that had fallen down, and I noticed a paper bag under the tree, and you know, went over there and pulled it out. It was a 6-pack of Canadian Ace Ale. It had a church key in it. I mean, somebody put it there. They were coming back. But they were going to be disappointed, because when they came back. And I asked my buddy, I said, "You want one?" And he says, "Sure." I opened one for him and opened one for me. And we sat there and talked, and I drank mine, and he drank about half of his. And I said, "Well, you want another one?" And he said, "No." He said, "I don't want another one." He said, I don't want to be a drinker like my father is." And his father was an alcoholic, and he didn't want to be like his father. His parents had been divorced for years, but his father still carried that reputation of being a heavy drinker because he deserved it. And the odd thing about it is that my father was an alcoholic. My father had gone to University of Virginia and written home to his fiancée and my mother, and told her that he had solved the drink problem, whatever that was. I don't know how he had solved it, because he stayed drunk pretty well from there on. But he was a functioning alcoholic. And in 1957, he had been nominated to a federal judgeship, and he had gone out with his brother to celebrate, and had gotten drunk, and he came home and fell down the basement steps and had a concussion, and he ended up dying a couple of months later. And I was in the service at that time, and I came home on emergency leave, and And he was lying in the hospital bed. He'd been hospitalized, and they thought he'd die most any time. So they called all the relatives in, as they do. And I came over, and I sat down beside him, and I said, not knowing what his condition really was and how desperate it really was, and I said, "Do you know me?" And he said, "Yes, you're James R. Martin." And I'm James Richard, and he had been writing me over the years my service address. He had addressed it to James R. Martin. And those are the last words he ever said. And he closed his eyes. It was as if he was waiting for me to come. And he died. And I was hurt by that, not only because he had died, but because I loved him, and he was consistent in the household. My mother was inconsistent. You know, he'd come home drunk and she'd raise hell, and then the next night they'd sit and drink, and she'd drink with him, and, you know, it was very confusing. At least my father drank, you know. So I knew what he was up to. But I'd offered Ed another Canadian Ace ale. I never did like ale. But anyway, I offered him another, and he said no, he didn't want one. And I wanted to have another one, but I didn't take it. Instead, I took the bag and what was remaining in it and hid it somewhere else with the idea that I would come back and get it later. So when you start hiding your drinks when you're 13 or 14 years old, you got a ways to go, I'll tell you. And but I drank my way through high school and did well there. I was right in the midst of the Korean War, and I was either going to be drafted or something. And I wasn't ready to go to college yet, because you get a deferment if you do that. And so I ended up joining the Air Force, and I spent most of my time in England, and I was an air traffic controller, control tower, GCA, and approach control. And I had a hell of a good war. I had a good time. The only battle, or the nearest battle I saw, was the Battle of Piccadilly Circus. There are some people here who know what I'm talking about. The others would have to wash your ears out if you heard it. So, or would want me to wash my mouth out, whichever the case may be. But I had a good time. I drank all the time. I drank as frequently as I possibly could. And certainly in the last few months, I drank daily. And you're not supposed to drink and go on duty. You're supposed to have at least 8 hours away from it, and as I recall. But I had a good time, and I had a good war, and I came back and on emergency leave. My father died, and I went to college and joined the fraternity. And I did that because there was always drinking going on. There was about 60 guys in the fraternity, and there was always somebody who was ready, willing, and able to go drinking. So I was ready to party, that's all. You know, my brother was the president of this particular fraternity, and he couldn't refuse me, I suppose. But I kind of drank my way through college. I didn't make terribly bad grades or anything like that. As a matter of fact, I never got a degree, but I have 160 credit hours. Some one of these days, I'm going to put them all together and see what they make. By that time, I won't have a brain enough to make any difference. But the thing that I looked forward to when I was going to college was the parties that were going on. And I was had a part-time job at a radio station. I was a messenger. And which I made enough money to be able to drink on, along with the GI Bill, and I had a good time. And that's all I was interested in doing, was having a good time. I'd get involved in the programming end of broadcasting, and I enjoyed that greatly. And then they decided I was capable of doing more than that. My potential was greater, so they got me involved in sales, and I was involved in sales and sales management and radio and television for 27 years. And I had a good time. I was a musical program director for this rock station there in Washington, D.C. And this was in the heyday of Pat Boone and all those people. And these guys would come in and go on these tours and to plug their records and that sort of thing. And they'd come around and with the idea that the disc jockey or me in this case would be impressed by having a star there to come see them. And they were just another bunch of jerks as far as I was concerned. They were taking up my time. I had a job to do. And if they wanted to buy, I was willing to drink. I mean, I'd drop anything I was doing, go drink with them. But I had a great time. And I remember there was a DJ convention in Miami, and it was about, oh, I don't know, 58 or 59 or something like that. And they had this show, and Peggy Lee was a headliner, and she sang Fever, introduced that. And all of the music people, whether it was a recording industry or publishers or writers or whatever they were, they had hospitality rooms. And one hospitality room, I think that they were selling shoes. I'm not sure, because I went in there and there was a bunch of women in there, and all they had on was shoes. So I particularly liked that. I quickly developed a shoe fetish. But I had a great time. I was overpaid and underworked and had a great time. And I drank during this period of time as much as I possibly could. I was married and had two kids. And I had a wife that, you know, I told her if she'd marry me that I'd teach her how to drink if she'd teach me how to dance. And she never taught me how to dance, and I never taught her how to drink. But somehow or another, I did something to her life, because after she divorced me, she married twice and divorced twice more. Pardon me. And I had a tough time, because during those years, those early years of the 60s, I was arrested 23 times for public intoxication and twice for being in possession of a vehicle while intoxicated, once for urinating in public. I've done that several times since then. I've never been arrested for it. But I kept having... When you drink in the Town and Country Inn in the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C., they expect you to comport yourself in a sober manner. Whether you're sober or not doesn't make any difference, but they don't want you walking out this way. You know, they expect you to walk in a straight line. They'd stand out there. The cops would be out there. They had a cop on every door, because a lot of congressmen and senators lived in the hotel. And they didn't want drunks in there. And I'd walk out, and they'd say, okay, come on. And I'd go to the precinct and spend 4 hours there, and they'd fine me $10 and that sort of thing. And, you know, I was always on the edge of trouble, never able to explain myself. I'd come home, my wife would ask me, where you been? And if I knew, I couldn't tell her. And if I didn't know, I'd make some, I don't know. I don't know where I was. That didn't any answer, so I'd have to lie about it and say, well, I was with George or whatever it was, you know. And it just kind of went on and on and on. I thought I was some sort of a sophisticate or something. When I was in college, I was a member of a an organization called the Saturday Afternoon Martini Club. We met on Sunday afternoons. But once a year, we chipped in our money and would have a catered dinner set up for us with wine and this, that, and the other. And we have somebody prepare the food and wait on the table and so on and so forth. And we drank a lot. And my wife thought that this was cute. I was about 7 years older than she was. And had been exposed to a lot of things that she hadn't been exposed to. And she thought that, you know, it was great to be with someone who had an experienced person in her life, because she didn't have much. And we got in an argument. This was about midnight. She wanted to go home. So I said, okay, I'll take you home. So we got in the car and I drove home and drove her home. She got out of the car and I put the car in reverse and went back to the party. And without saying where I was going or anything else. And I got over there and I get people asked me where my wife was, so I took her home. Why didn't you stay? And, you know, people were sticking their nose in my business and, you know, fingering my face and telling me what to do with my life. And even my friends were doing that. And they gave me a bottle of scotch to get rid of me, and I drove back towards Washington, D.C., and I stopped at an overlook of the Potomac River, and I was just sitting there. It says, on a Sunday morning, and the sun was up. It must have been about 7 o'clock, I guess. And I sat there and thought to myself, what am I going to do now? I don't have any place to go. I'm going to have to change clothes. I have to go to work tomorrow, so on and so forth. You know, the usual, what am I going to do? And there was a knock on the window, left-hand side. I turned around, and there was an old guy. He may not have been old, but he appeared to be old to me. And he had three or four day growth of beard. Was dirty. Obviously, he'd been sleeping in the bushes. And I lowered the window and asked him what he wanted. And he says, I really need a drink. And I thought to myself, Jesus. That's what I'm going to end up doing. I'm going to be that. This guy is just a picture of me. That's all there is to it, if I keep this up. And I gave him the bottle. He asked for a cigarette, and I gave him the cigarettes. And started the car, left, and went back to my home. My wife was there with her mother, two kids. And I told them about this, told them what had happened, that I had seen this guy. And they said that, you know, oh, well, maybe you've reached some sort of a pinnacle here, Dick. Maybe this is it. Maybe you can stay sober. And I said, well, I'll never drink again. I will just never drink again. You know, this, I know that this is what's going to happen to me. And so they forgave me for whatever moment it was, and I went to bed. And I woke up about noon, and I was in my boxer shorts. I went into the kitchen, opened the refrigerator, pulled out a can of beer, popped it with a church key, stand there drinking out of this can of beer. My wife came in. She said, what are you doing? You said you were never going to drink again. And what are you doing? You know, 3 hours later, here you are drinking again. And I said, I don't know. I couldn't say, you know, I can't not drink. I just couldn't say it. Because she wouldn't understand that. And I didn't understand it. But I remember sitting there on the floor. And I ended up drinking all the beer that was in the refrigerator. And I just sat there in the kitchen. And she took the kids, went down to her mother's, and next time I woke up, I was there in a puddle of urine, and God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And somehow or another, I got up and cleaned up and went to work that day. And it wasn't an unusual day or anything like that. But it was just one of those things, you know, what in the hell am I going to do? I'm not in trouble with anybody at work. I knew that. But I didn't know what other trouble I might be in, because God knows what I've been doing. But I began a series of times when the only thing I would think, what am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this problem? How am I going to get out? Where am I going to get the money to do this? Where am I going to do that? How am I going to make the mortgage payment on this house? And how am I going to take care of these kids? You know, just why can't I be like other people? And then I'd take a drink and that feeling would go away and I would be okay again, and I'd go see a psychiatrist or go see a doctor, or, you know, I saw a minister a couple of times. And, you know, all of these people, if they put this spiritual, physical, mental modalities together, if it could have been one man sharing also his experience about drinking, perhaps I could have done something. But they couldn't do it. I went to one psychiatrist twice a week for over a year and a half. And people who go to a psychiatrist are nuts. I mean, you got to understand that. If they weren't nuts, they wouldn't go to a psychiatrist. But I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me. I said, doctor, last day I went to him, I said, doctor, I said, you know, when I came here, you gave me a battery of tests, but you never told me what the resultant was. And he said, well, you never asked. And I wanted to jump up and kill the son of a bitch. I mean, that's the way psychiatrists talk to you. And I said, all right, doctor. I said, what was the resultant of these tests? And he said, you seem to be preoccupied with sex. I thought to myself, you know, must be some sort of a pervert or something. I was. And I said, well, when do you think I'll feel any relief from these life problems? And he said, Dick, how old are you? And I said, I'm 33. And he said, it took you a long time to get here, didn't it? I mean, if he realized I was so tight, I mean, I was really, I could barely speak. I was so angry. And I thought to myself, I'm going to have to go to this guy for 33 years, for God's sake. And he's much older than I am. He'll die. What'll I do then? And I said, well, I have one more question, doctor. I said, do you think I should go to AA? Or do you think I'm an alcoholic? And do you think I should go to AA? And he said, no. He says, you're not ready for that yet. And I said, well, regardless of that, don't send me a bill, because I'm not going to pay it. I've been paying you all along, but I'm not going to pay for this. And I got up and walked out, because he had nothing to offer. I thought that I had told him the truth, and I believe I did tell him the truth. I explained to him about my drinking and the things that I did. He said, you have to drink 20 long, hard years to become an alcoholic. Poor fellow. He misdiagnosed a lot of people, including me. But that was in 1965, in the spring of 1965, and I drank all summer, and I continued to have this affair with the boss's secretary, the secretary of the company, really. And I'd met her when I first started working there some years before. We'd begun an affair before I even met my wife-to-be, and we continued to have this affair and drinking together and so on. All during the time I was courting my wife, during the time that we were married, had two kids, and so on and so forth. You know, the strange thing about it, is I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. I really didn't think. I knew that I wasn't supposed to tell my wife about it. I had sense enough of that. But I didn't think I was committing adultery. I couldn't put a label on it. And, you know, when I got sober, I began to look at my life a little bit, and I thought, Jesus, you know, what a rotten son of a bitch you were. And I really was. And that's, you know, when you come to a realization like that and don't have anything, don't know what to do about it, that's not very good. This gal, Joe, and I had gone out drinking on a Tuesday night, the 13th of September, and we had both gotten awfully drunk. She had gotten so drunk I had to carry her to her car because she was too drunk to walk. But she could drive. Chivalry wasn't dead. I mean, you help a lady when she needs help, you know. And we were supposed to get together the next night on Wednesday, and I called her up the next day and said, look, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing you tonight, but I said, I can't do the drinking like I did last night. I'm burning hard coal, and I'm just hung over in a terrible shape. And I said, well, why don't we meet at the Chevy Chase Inn, and then we'll go to the Avalon Theater. There was some movie playing that she agreed that she'd like to see. And so we went to the Chevy Chase Inn. So I'd seen, driven by the marquee and seen the movie had changed. And so I said, well, the movie's changed, and neither one of us wanted to see that. And we sat there and had a drink, and I said, well, let's go out to Angler's Inn. Angler's Inn is a high-dollar country inn, also overlooking the Potomac River, which apparently plays a large part in my life. I don't know. But we went out there, and what we had for dinner, I don't recall. But I know we had two bottles of wine with dinner. And after dinner, we had some after-dinner drink, and we went back to the Chevy Chase Inn. They had a sidewalk cafe there, and we sat there at the sidewalk cafe, and we're drinking Remy Martin Grand Fin Champagne Cognac and coffee. I don't want to give you the wrong impression. I wasn't wealthy or well off. I owed everybody. And I didn't have anything, but I owed a lot of money. And I owed $13,000, which doesn't sound like a lot of money today. But if you multiply that times 20, that's about what the comparative is today. I didn't know how I was going to pay that back, but I had received an American Express card that day in the mail, and I didn't want the American Express people to think I didn't like them, so I started abusing that. But during this conversation, I was sitting there drinking cognac. She asked me to marry her. And I had, up to that point, I had exactly the right amount to drink. I haven't had one drink too many or one drink short. I had just the right amount. Because the thought came to me, I can't marry her. I'm already married. And I'm a rotten husband. And I'm not a good father. And I'm not a good son or brother. We work in the same place, and we'd never make it to work. I'm not a good citizen. I'm not a good neighbor. I just looked at her and I said, no, I can't do that. And I paid the bill, got in my car, and saw her. I mean, there was little, if any, conversation after that. I don't recall any. But if she used to drive her Mercedes, and even the secretary of the corporation wasn't making the kind of money that allow him to have her Mercedes, and I knew that she had some inheritance. If I'd realized how much money she had, you'd have a different speaker this morning. I 2 years after I came to AA, she ended up dying. And she had come into the residue of the state, which was net to her $27 million. I really wouldn't be here. She built a house down in St. Thomas and up on the hill. And she died as a result of an overdose of pills and booze. And I would have been right there because that's the kind of person I am. But I just looked at her and said, no, I can't do that. And I went home and I was living with my mother, but this time my widowed mother, my maiden sister. And there I was, 33 years old, going back home to live with mommy again, you know, because I couldn't afford to live anywhere else. That's why I went there. And it offered me some protection of some sort, I suppose. But I went home that night and I sat on the edge of my bed and I said, you know, Jesus Christ, what am I going to do? What can I do with myself? Why can't I be like other people? Why can't I drink like other people? Why can't I have relationships like other people do? You know, what is the matter with me? I'd been everywhere to get help that I knew to go. And I didn't know what to do. And the thought came to me that when I was a boy, I used to sell Saturday Evening Post door to door. And in March 1941, they published an article in there by a fellow named Jack Alexander. And Jack Alexander was an investigative reporter, and he had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had been offered a job to debunk AA, and that is to prove that it really was a phony thing. And he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and Bill Wilson took him to meetings and so on and so forth. And he wrote a glowing article which was published in the Saturday Evening Post. And it was talked about alcoholics, one alcoholic helping another, and talked about when you're, you know, my impression was, sitting on the edge of that bed was that once you went to Alcoholics Anonymous, you never left. And once you stopped drinking, you never drank again. Imagine my surprise when after I came into AA and people started having slips around me. What's the matter with you, dummy? You're not supposed to do that. But I thought to myself, that's the only thing I haven't done. I haven't been to AA. So the next morning I got up and I didn't take a drink that morning. I sat up in bed and I thought, I'm going to call that minister, Tom. And he had volunteered to take me to an AA meeting one time, and it was inconvenient. I had a date to get drunk, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, I called him, and I told him I was drinking more and enjoying it less, and I'd appreciate it if he'd do something with this AA thing. And he said, well, we had a guy in the parish who just is a member of AA, and I'll put him in touch with you. And this fellow, Kelly Brown, called me, and he said that he hadn't been sober long enough to go on a 12-step call, but he'd have his sponsor call me, and he had this guy called me, this fellow named Buck gave me a call. And we had arranged to meet at the corner of Foxhall and Reservoir Roads in Washington, D.C. And he took me to my first meeting. My first meeting was a service member of a service meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the area chairman was a guy by the name of Ernie the Attorney, who is still sober today. And Ernie was explaining the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after he had gotten through doing that, I was taken over to a hot shop, which is like a village inn or non-alcoholic restaurant. And it taken me over there, and this fellow, Ernie the Attorney, and a guy I came to know as No Growth McGee, and lovable old Bucky Doyle 12-stepped me in the traditional sense of the word. They told me what they were like and what had happened and what they're like today. And as this went on, I mean, all three of these guys were talking, and not the same time, obviously, but they were talking and telling parts of their story. And I said, wait a minute, where'd you guys find this out about me? Where'd you find this out? You don't, you know, how did you, I just talked to you this morning, Buck. I said, how did you find this out? I said, we aren't talking about you, Dick. We're talking about us. And perhaps if you relate to what we're saying, maybe you're like we are. And I suggest what you do is go to a meeting every night for 6 weeks. He says 6 weeks isn't a long time. It's not a short time. But it's enough to get the most of the booze out of your system, and you're able to think a little bit better. And besides that, if you decide at the end of that 6 weeks you're not an alcoholic, chances are you have saved up a buck or two, and you can really go out and throw one. And that seemed reasonable enough to me. It really did. And I knew, if these guys were alcoholics, I knew that I was an alcoholic. I didn't have any doubt of that in that in my mind at all. And, which is a good thing. So I went to my second meeting. Actually, the next day I went to they have an AA businessmen's lunch.